on ABC Radio National, it's time for Counterpoint, an hour of opinion and discussion with Paul Comrie-Thompson and Michael Duffy.
Hello and welcome to the program. My co-host Michael Duffy is away on assignment this week, but before his departure, he recorded an interview that is part disquieting and part bleeding hilarious. It is about the erosion of personal liberties in the UK. As you will hear, in many parts of contemporary Britain, handing out a flyer for a church fete, a comedy club, or musical gathering could land you in big trouble. Michael's guest, Josie Appleton, is director of the Manifesto Club, an organisation that opposes the hyper-regulation of everyday life. She tells us about her organisation's campaign to overturn leafleting laws, which, amongst other things, prohibit you from telling the neighbourhood about your little lost pussycat. And with United States President Barack Obama launching his 2012 election campaign, for some people, life is about to get ugly again. You may be a journalist and a novelist in Obama's America, but if you are a conservative, like our guest Harry Stein, it can be a lonely place to be. In this classic Counterpoint from 2009, Harry talks us through his book, which has the delightful title, I Can't Believe I'm Sitting Next to a Republican. First up today, we look at the real world of spooks. In the British television series, MI5's Sir Harry Pierce and his crew get involved in some delightful adventures. But in the real world of MI5, Britain's Internal Security Service has just released documents relating to Australia's biggest spy scandal, the Petrov Affair of 1954. And Neil James, from the Australia Defence Association, is highly critical of what two academics, Robert Mann and David McKnight, had to say about these documents in a newspaper article headlined, Spy Chief Told UK to Boycott Evatt as PM. I spoke to Neil James late last week. Neil James, in the newspaper story, Robert Mann says, and I quote, when I interviewed Spry in the mid-1980s, he told me he was suspicious of Evatt, but for him to have said to MI5, don't trust my own government, if Evatt becomes Prime Minister, is a really big deal. What would be your comment on that?
Well, I think like a lot of the sensationalism that flows from the Petrov affair, this is just another example. It's our understanding that that's not what Spry said. What Spry said was that if Evatt became Prime Minister, there may be a problem due to Evatt's mental instability. He wasn't insinuating that the British should cut off the flow of information to other Australian cabinet ministers and officials.
Robert Mann says further, just to get your comment on this, he, Spry, may have thought he was acting in Australia's interest, but it is an astonishing thing to do, and I'm afraid it throws a very different light on Spry again. The suggestion is that Spry was acting contrary to Australia's interests.
Well, we'd argue that that's probably a bit of overkill in a description. I mean, Spry didn't actually say directly to the British government that Evatt couldn't be trusted. When sounded out by the MI5 liaison officer in Australia, he pointed out that Evatt's mental instability could be a problem. And in fact, it would have been quite within his professional duties to do so, and you could argue that it, in fact, given our close alliance with the United Kingdom, when we're talking about UK-supplied information to Australia, he would have been derelict in his duty not to pass on the assessment that Evatt's mental instability would be likely to cause a problem.
Now, just to return to an earlier point, the key communication of this event, I just want to quote it to you. On April 12, 1954, 9 days after the Petrov defection, this is quoting from the story, MI5's representative in Australia, Derek Hamblin, sent a cable to London which said, Spry states that in the event of Evatt becoming PM, UK government should seriously consider withholding important secrets. Is that what Spry said, or do you think that's a misstatement?
Well, we don't know whether that's what Spry said. All we have is the MI5 liaison officer's views. And obviously in those days, if cablegrams keeping things short, it doesn't go into nuance and context. You know, I'd like to see a little bit more evidence before Spry's reputation is further blackened by left-wing historians.
This is one of the problems. You've got a cable with words. A comment was made once, someone was writing history of a political party, and he said, "I have all the letters." And someone said, "Yes, but have you got all the telephone conversations?" Nuance is very important. But let's proceed further with some of the criticisms that have been made of Spry. Robert Mann says, Spry's critics will be claiming vindication, but it's very hard for us to understand today that Australia was not a truly independent country at that time. How do you respond to that description of Australia in 1954 as being not truly independent?
Well, it depends whether he's talking of constitutional independence or strategic independence, of course, and whilst we were constitutionally independent then, to all intents and purposes, and had been since the Balfour Declaration in the 1920s and the Statute of Westminster a few years later on, we weren't strategically independent then. We were part of a wider Western alliance, and in fact, today we still are. And the problem with discussing the Petrov defection and the work of ASIO in that time, and indeed the work of Soviet espionage in Australia, is people forget the historical context of the times. I mean, this was a high point in the Cold War. The Korean War armistice had only just come into effect. We still had soldiers in Korea occupying frontline trenches because it was an armistice, not a peace agreement. We were helping the then Federation of Malaya defeat a communist insurgency in Malaya. There'd been a divisive referendum in Australia on banning the Communist Party. The Communist Party was very strong in Australian trade unions at the time and parts of the Labor Party. And this is largely forgotten, this context, when people are discussing the threat of Soviet espionage. I mean, this was a major strategic threat to Australia at the time, not just internally, but also externally. And therefore, Australia's counterintelligence agency was duty-bound to take a hard line on it.
Neil James, you've also written the security environment in 54 was coloured by the previous Labor government's unwillingness to accept that Soviet espionage was very active in Australia. That perhaps is not appreciated by some commentators.
Well, I don't think it's widely appreciated at all now. And, you know, the penetration of the Australian Department of Foreign Affairs, in particular during the 1940s, was what led Chifley to create ASIO in the first place, because the British and Americans had found out, and this has since been proven in the Venona transcripts, of you know, KGB communications, that Australia had been thoroughly penetrated. But worse than that was the reluctance of Evatt and his secretary, Burton, just refused to take this seriously. And so you've got this long-term problem, you know, only 3 or 4 years later, that if the then Labor opposition came to power with a leader who was commonly accepted at the time by many people, and most Labor memoirs since have talked about this, was mentally ill, you know, it was an unprecedented situation for Australia to be in. And it's not unrealistic in those circumstances for people to express, you know, that there might be a problem if Evatt became Prime Minister.
Now, further to that, one of the academics quoted in the article that ran in The Australian, David McKnight, he says, Spry's action, I presume this is what he means, Spry's action means there would certainly have been a national security crisis if Evatt was elected. You're suggesting there may have been a national security crisis, but because of the nature of Evatt himself.
Well, that's pretty much the case. And luckily, later on, the circumstances changed where, you know, and this was actually brought in by Gough Whitlam, where opposition leaders were briefed on important intelligence matters and on important counterintelligence operations. And that's pretty much the convention that's continued down to the present day. But back there in the early 1950s, there was just such incredible suspicion on both sides of politics. You know, you had people on the left claiming that, you know, Reds under the bed scares were conjured up by Menzies, and you had people on the right who believed that the Labor Party had been badly penetrated by communists. Now, as we know now from looking at it objectively, there was a fair bit of truth in both allegations, but certainly the problem of communist penetration of Australia and of Australian political parties, particularly Labor, you know, is now established fact, although it's still denied by left-wing historians like McKnight.
Yes, it's interesting, Neil. We're going back to another time, 1954. A lot of young academics, of course, weren't around then. They perhaps weren't even born. And you've stated that no modern Australian political party would elect or retain a leader as mentally ill as Evatt. It was a very different Labor Party in those days, wasn't it?
Well, it certainly was. And if you read the memoirs of people like Clyde Cameron and Diamond Jim McClelland and other Labor leaders of the time, I mean, you know, it becomes quite clear that many of them at the time suspected that Evatt was mentally unbalanced, but they were just unable to do anything about it because of, you know, the ideological fervour of the times. And I think we should all be thankful that in this day and age, at the moment a leader's mental instability becomes questioned, you know, his leadership ambitions or time in the leadership, you know, tends to be of short duration. No one looking at Evatt's life and looking at Evatt's statements and his bizarre behaviour at and after the Royal Commission into Soviet espionage, and then later on when he bizarrely split the Labor Party, you know, based on paranoid fantasies to a large extent, would believe that, you know, someone like Evatt should ever lead a modern Australian political party.
Neil James, that's why you state, contrary to academic assessments, that at that time, 1954, the head of ASIO was surely duty-bound to advise such key allies of his professional opinion about Evatt's incapacities.
Look, we would stand by that description. I mean, what people are forgetting here is that it was British-supplied information. Now, if the British were supplying information and intelligence to Australia and there was a threat to the integrity and the security of this information from Australia, then obviously Australia had to tell them that was the case. Now, in the case where this threat might arise from someone who might become Australian Prime Minister, then obviously, you know, that information needs to be passed on. This wasn't a case of disloyalty. It was a case of an unprecedented situation. The professional head of our security intelligence agency had to make some real hard choices. And I think it's to Spry's credit that he was willing to advise the British that there may be a problem with Evatt. What he wasn't suggesting is that the problem was mental instability and incapacity was more widespread than Evatt. And he certainly wasn't suggesting that the British should not share their information with other Australian ministers and officials.
Apart from giving advice to the UK, is there any evidence that you've found that Spry was actively working to undermine Evatt?
Look, I don't think any of the historians of that period have been able to find any evidence of this. Even the left-wing historians haven't. There's just a general assumption that because Spy was a retired brigadier and obviously probably conservative in his own politics, he was probably working against the Labor Party. But that assumption really, they haven't been able to find any proof of it. And, you know, my understanding is in that period, most senior officers at ASIO, Spry included, acted extremely professionally. Now, Spry himself deteriorated a little bit in the mid to late 1960s, but at the time of the Petrov defection, I think ASIO and its staff handled themselves extremely professionally in a very politically polarised and difficult situation.
Neil James, that was more than 50 years ago now. In terms of security sharing with our key allies, is it fruitful?
Look, it's vital. I mean, one of the reasons Australia can get by under-investing in defence is because of the quality of the intelligence that's shared with us by our allies. You know, if we had to duplicate that ourselves, then we'd obviously have to invest a lot more in our own intelligence gathering and assessment and probably in our own defence capabilities. But these are always controversial areas of public policy. And I suspect they'll continue to be so for the foreseeable future.
Neil James, in your understanding, do any of our allies ever get original intelligence generated in Australia?
Well, yes, they do, and they get a lot, in fact, on our area of the world. In effect, what happens in practice is the world is divided up into areas, and certain members of the Western Alliance have responsibility for the provision of information on their area. And there's no doubt that the United States, for example, depends heavily on Australian assessments provided in Southeast Asia and the Southwest Pacific and the Western Pacific in particular.
Neil James, just as a light relief question, Do you still watch Spooks on ABC TV, and has it got any connection with the real world?
Look, it has little or no connection with the real world, but I suspect, like many former intelligence officers, we watch Spooks occasionally, only because it's so wildly amusing and how unrealistic it is. You know, the idea that such a small team of people would be able to do so much and have so many wide responsibilities and do it so quickly is just nonsensical. But just as most medical dramas and most police dramas aren't exactly realistic about medical and police matters, and I think anyone who took Spooks seriously really hasn't read up on things.
Neil James, thanks for talking to Counterpoint.
Thank you, Paul.
Neil James, the Executive Director of the Australia Defence Association, reminding us that defence and intelligence matters are a lot more complex than as portrayed on ABC One on Saturday nights, but I still wouldn't miss it for quids.